Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thanks for joining me wherever you are. As I mentioned last week, I have set up a Patreon page, so if you'd like to support the podcast, please go to the Patreon site, www.patreon.com/voicesfromsa, all one word, lowercase. And for the price of a couple of coffees per episode, I'd appreciate your support, or more. Don't feel constrained by that limit. It'll allow me to move around the country a bit more, find more amazing people, and tell you more incredible stories. My guest this week is Dr. Zubeida Dangal. She's the founder and the director of, she's one of the founders, and the director of the NISA Institute for Women's Development, an organization that has the goal of enabling women and children to live in a world free of violence. She's also the executive head of the National Shelter Movement. I've been wanting to get a guest on the podcast to talk about the scourge of gender and domestic violence in our country for quite some time, and so I was very happy that Zubeida was able to take time from her incredible schedule to chat to me. And it's a sobering and at sometimes quite gritty discussion. Gave me and I hope will give you a picture of what it is like working on the front lines of the war against domestic violence, if I could use that phrase, and the immense work, the thankless and extremely stressful work that is done by social workers, counselors, and that whole network, mainly working for very little money in this NGO, NPO sector. Just the commitment that these people have is just—it's quite amazing. It's sobering. What comes out of the conversation is that the government response from the sort of stakeholder ministries, even on the very basic level, is sorely lacking. And I suppose on the part of the private sector as well. Just very little, just a real token attitudes and gestures here and there, and no real grip on the vast nature of the problems. She also spoke, Zubeida did, about her childhood and her journey to forming NISA back in 1994, April 1994, in fact. I did edit some of the personal discussion at Zubeida's request, but I think it does still make narrative sense. So please now enjoy my chat with Zubeida. May I call you Zubeida?
Yes, please do.
Zubeida, thanks very much for your time today. You are doing some incredible work, and I'm looking forward to our discussion this morning. I think it was probably about 6 months ago that I first made contact with you, and I think that was probably around Women's Day or Women's Month or 60, one of these sort of campaign times that we have in South Africa around gender violence. And we will obviously talk a little bit in more detail about some of the work you're doing. But I thought I would start by asking you, you're the executive director for the NISA Institute for Women's Development, that is headquartered here in Lazio, has offices in Soweto and Orange Farm. And then you're also the head of the National Shelter Movement?
Yeah, the executive head, yeah.
The executive head of the National Shelter Movement. And I think that's going to give us an opportunity to discuss a lot of issues around gender and violence and related issues, related matters, because I think it's always important that we put this in some sort of context. Just if you could give us a little bit of background first, and we can maybe kick off with a little bit more of a discussion around NISA itself, enabling women and children to live in a world free of violence. You were formed in April 1994.
That's right.
Which is, I mean, the great month of our nation.
Yes.
I mean, how did that all come about?
Well, I was actually working for the...
You've been with NISA from the start?
I started it.
Yeah.
Actually, I was with the UNISA Health Psychology Unit.
Okay.
And I felt that we needed to have a women's organization to deal with these issues. And so what happened is that as part of the fundraising, they met a lot of women from Germany. And I was about to leave. Wasn't sure where I was going or what I was going to do.
You were going
exactly.
to leave?
I was
going to
leave that
UNICEF
job, yeah.
Right.
And they said to me, well, we've seen the work that you do. And if you want to start an all-women's thing, we would support you. And that's how NISA was born.
Right. And that was, I suppose...
End of 93.
End of 93, exactly. Here's my tea. Am I the only one drinking tea? You know.
Thanks. I've had tea earlier.
Thank you, ma'am. That was such an incredible... I mean, you must have been feeding off the energy of the nation at that point,
Absolutely.
Of the world, I suppose.
Absolutely. It was a wonderful period of time in my life, as well as, you know, wonderful opportunity. There was a lot of opportunity at the time for women, women's issues. There was a whole buzz. I was also involved in kind of in the elections. So I ran a voting station.
Oh, right, for the IEC.
For the IEC.
Okay.
And so that was also equally exciting.
Yes.
Because there was a huge momentum around
those
that
days,
time.
My goodness.
Yeah, so that's when NISA, in December 93, I remember we found a place at one of the community halls and sat and started thinking through and planning what we need to do, how we need to do it, putting in place policies and things already.
This was here in Lanesia?
Yeah, here in Lanesia.
It's interesting. Well, I suppose it's sad and kind of poignant that, you know, we're talking 25 years ago and these issues were, you know, that's the reason you formed NISA, was to sort of confront the scourge of violence against women and, I suppose, overall women's sort of position in society.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, how do you reflect on those 25 years when we just, when the body count just sort of, it seems an incessant assault.
So sometimes you feel you want to give up because, you know, been at this for a long time and change is very slow to come. And as you say, you know, the body count keeps increasing. But that's why we kind of do this work, and that's why we want to make sure that we do save lives, because women don't do it for themselves. They do it for themselves, their children, and their families. And it's so important to ensure that we're not losing more women, because, you know, the count, the femicide count in South Africa is that three women are killed every day. We might not hear of all of these deaths, but three women are killed every day in this country. And
normally by somebody that they know.
Yes. This is through intimate partner violence. And this is an extremely disturbing phenomenon for us. Mm. You know, it's very painful and it's very difficult for the families and the children to lose their mother.
Mm. You know? It's a global phenomenon. But somehow we seem to be at a sort of another level in terms of the psychology of this violence. I mean, how do you assess the sort of psychology of the nation, if I can put it that way, that sort of seems to cultivate this tragedy?
Well, I think, you know, we come from a very violent history, and one can't discount that. The fact that men in this country have been emasculated to a large degree, and when they can't find jobs and when they struggle to support families, their anger and violence is actually then carried through onto their families through unemployment, etc., etc. And I think this is one phenomenon. Then the whole question of patriarchy in the country is something that we're still dealing with. We haven't even got to the tip of the iceberg in trying to dismantle it. It's a huge problem for us. A few years ago, I did some work in Limpopo, and I worked with the municipality, and it was interesting that the men who were working with me there said to me, as far as our work goes, for work, it's fine. Issues of gender equality and all are important. But in my house, I am the head, and I will tell my wife what to do. So there was a kind of a disconnect. You know, the different set of values for men in the workplace versus in the home environment.
Interesting. How do you define patriarchy in the South African context in particular?
Well, I mean, patriarchy for me is looking at the power and control over women. It's also the values that people have imbibed over the years. But I think that apartheid had something to do with it. Colonization had something to do with it as well. So it kind of goes back. It's not a new phenomenon. We might not have worked with it directly those years ago. But more and more as you continue, you realize that this emasculation, you know, came through colonization, came through apartheid. And that has really affected a lot of men in this country, right? So attitudes and behavior, norms, customs, traditions. I'm not saying that those need to be thrown out. You know, you don't throw the baby out of the bathwater. But not all customs and traditions are necessarily healthy for families in the country. Then the issue around poverty, when people feel, and men in particular feel, that they're not able to take care of their families, that they don't have jobs or employment, this adds to the kind of pressure they feel. And I think in one way or another contributes to the violence that's experienced by their partners in the home.
Does Nisa mean anything?
Nisa is actually an Arabic word meaning woman.
Okay.
And although it's an Arabic word, we are basically completely non-denominational. We work with everybody across religious, across political lines. Our issue is not the politics or the ethnicity of the person coming in. Our issue is if you have been affected by gender-based violence in any way, then we are there to help and support as far as we possibly can.
Maybe you could just give us a little bit of a sense of the kind of services that NISA offers from its offices, because there are a number of things you do.
Okay, so we have three offices in different locations, and sometimes we've worked even outside of those locations. So we have an office in Orange Farm, Soweto, and Lanesia. And the kind of work that we do, we offer counseling to women that come from abusive relationships. And that's been there from inception. We offer a shelter service to women who are trying to leave their abusive relationships, and particularly those women whose lives are endangered by intimate partner violence. So the shelter is a second project, and in the shelter itself, women are offered counseling, the children are offered counseling, they offered accommodation and safety, They're helped with legal aspects. We work with organizations like Pro Bono and Martin Fuskenau, who come in on a regular basis. We have an arrangement, so for many years they've been coming in to assist our clients.
Right.
And where that's not possible, we also refer them to legal aid or other clinics like the Wits Clinic, because most of the women that we see are usually not able to afford legal fees.
Yeah.
And then in the shelter itself, there are programs that are run for the children. There are programs for the women. We also do skills development, but at this point in time, we don't do the skills development ourselves. We outsource it and partner with different community bodies that offer different kinds of skills.
Mm.
So in the local community, there's a group called Madrasa Aisha. They offer computer skills, they offer sewing, they teach women to cook, they do baking. Then we bring other people in. So we've done a range of other things, like we've had Zumba classes for women.
Zumba classes?
Zumba.
Oh, Zumba.
Zumba, yeah. Not Zuma. Sounds interesting.
I was wondering what that might be. Zumba?
Z-U-M-B-A, yeah.
Okay.
So somebody from the community wants to offer the... We've done craft classes and lessons for women. Mm. We also do a certain amount of provision of legal training. So the different acts that affect women, like the Domestic Violence Act, like the Maintenance Act, we have lawyers who then come in and offer training for the lay person to get an understanding of their rights in terms of those particular laws that affect them.
Mm.
We work with the police, we work with the prosecutors, the justice system, and a range of stakeholders in one way or another. Because remember, violence against women is not a woman's issue, it's a societal issue.
Mm.
And everybody needs to come to the party to be able to end the scourge. And I think fundamentally over the years what we found, there isn't enough responsibility taken by a range of stakeholders in dealing with this issue.
Mm.
And this is what we found with
specifically
government as well.
Stakeholders such as?
Government as well.
Mm.
So what happens with government is you have... DSD, the Department of Social Development, which is the lead department for shelters,
okay.
Right? However, they also have to work with other departments, like the Department of Health, like a range of other departments, correctional services.
The police, I suppose.
The police as well. But
the justice system.
The justice system. So we found the Department of Health really wanting. They really don't play a role that is sufficiently effective in dealing with gender-based violence. And this has also been corroborated very recently in December. The National Shelter Movement was invited, and I presented a paper at the hearings of the Commission for Gender Equality in Johannesburg. And how that came about was that the commission had conducted some studies on shelters, and on the basis of their investigative findings had called us to present and called the relevant government departments to come and account for what they do and how they focus on gender-based violence. And I think that was a very telling experience, because it was very clear how the departments did or didn't do their work, particularly as far as violence against women goes. So they've been called on to actually start doing more in terms of this issue. Mm. Many departments, even human settlements, were not really kind of linking to gender-based violence, and housing is a huge issue.
Housing?
Yes, because remember, if a woman leaves her house with her children, she comes to a shelter. A shelter is a temporary place.
Yeah.
It's a place where she finds respite. It's a place where she gets empowered, where her children get empowered. But eventually, she's able to stand up for herself, has become a lot more independent than she first was when she walked into the shelter. Then, if she decides that she's leaving her partner, where does she go to? And unfortunately, we have not had the support of human settlements. Neither have we had the support of the municipality in terms of prioritized housing for women. The other thing is, in South Africa, we do lag behind. Other countries have second and third stage housing that's provided by their governments. We don't have that yet. Some shelters have managed to offer some of those services themselves from the money they raise, or and they're usually like church organizations. Mm-hmm. But not we can't do this by and large for all women that are actually leaving shelters. Mm-hmm. So this
and
becomes
we're talking,
a problem.
I mean, thousands of women then, obviously.
Oh yeah, over the years it's quite clearly thousands of women. Mm-hmm. Because remember, what we found with the research that we've done, more than 70% of women don't go back to their abusive partners from the research we've conducted. Mm. But they're forced to sometimes. They don't have housing, they don't have jobs, or they don't earn adequately, and they have children to look after. Where do you go if you're not going into the streets?
Yeah.
And so this becomes a fundamentally problematic issue.
I think that's one aspect of this whole situation that a lot of people don't understand. You know, it's like they flippantly, why doesn't she just leave him, you know? And
it's very commonly asked, and I feel that asking that question is actually blaming the woman.
Yes. It's a lack of understanding of the situation.
Completely.
Mm. I want to talk about the National Shelter Movement, but before that, you did mention an interim presidential committee.
Interim Gender-Based Violence and Femicide Committee, IGBVF we call it.
And that was something that came out of the Gender Summit in November 2018.
Yes, that's right.
So could you just maybe give us an understanding of what the purpose of this presidential committee is, and sort of given what you've just said about the sort of lack of support from sort of state institutions that should be sort of taking this matter much more seriously, where do you see now the role of government? I mean, is there a shift now, or is this all just words in response to public outcry,
this committee hasn't been in action for that long, but there has been a certain amount of prioritization through the president, and the committee meets kind of every 2 weeks. What we've done is
who sort of makes up the committee about
okay,
this?
Okay, so there are different organizations that were invited.
Okay.
To actually join the committee.
NGOs and state.
NGOs and state, as well as UN, some UN bodies as well. And so together, I think one of the big things that's happened is that they've come up with a national strategic plan, which is kind of on the cusp of being finalized. So that's a plan for the whole country. The second thing is that they have gotten people to start looking at funding. So, for example, government has tried to make funds available through the CARA funds, which is the Criminal Assets Recovery Program. Uh-huh. So, you know, that's bail money and things like that. So they've just put out a call for proposals. The other thing that's happened is government has hired additional social workers to go and assist in particular organizations and areas, and particularly with the TCCs.
TCCs?
The Tutuzela Care Centers.
Okay.
Where usually rape victims go there. There's a policeman, there's a nurse, there's supposed to be a a social worker or a counselor available at some of these centers. So they have been sending people through there. The problem with that we find is that there's a huge discrepancy between the funds that are allocated for salaries for social workers in NGOs like us versus social workers who work for government. Huge. And this becomes a real problem. How do you justify that? Secondly, in shelters, although we have the minimum wage, which has been, which has come into law, not all shelters staff are receiving even the minimum wage.
Sure.
So this is a fundamental problem because it's a breach of our constitution, you know, and that money comes from government. So we want to be sure that people are getting at least the minimum wage, because you have to understand that the people who work in shelters are frontline people. They are exposed to a lot of secondary and vicarious trauma that nobody will understand if you have not worked in a shelter or you don't deal with abuse of women. You know, it's trauma upon trauma.
It's a psychological drain on them.
It's a huge psychological and emotional drain on them, on their resources, on their resilience. And people do this work. But what's really important is that we need to support them. You need to be able to give them a reasonable living allowance. You need to be able to support them. They need to get debriefing. Because if you don't do that, what happens is that they very quickly burn out in shelters.
And then they're no use to...
Then they're no use, because then, you know, if they burnt out and they're working in a shelter, what happens is that then you start blaming your clients and you you become...
Start to hate your work environment.
Exactly, you know. You can't... So therefore, people need to be given a break from this work, but they also need to be treated more appropriately.
So there's a kind of disconnect just on... I mean, you were saying yourself now, NISA itself is in a funding crisis. I mean... you have sort of government with these, you know, days of activism and all these campaigns, etc., etc. Seems to be a sort of long way off just giving practical, on-the-ground assistance to what seems to be, actually, if you look at it, quite a vast network of support that exists within the sort of NGO sector.
Oh, yes. The NGOs...
At lots of layers that the government should actually be just... doesn't even need to reinvent the wheel, just needs to fund these initiatives accordingly. And that is a whole level of support
that is... Because NGOs in South Africa are doing the real work. Government has not been able to offer these services. Right, but the problem is that we don't want to run a mediocre service, but our hands are tied, because on the one hand you get funding, but it's very limited. We've got to dovetail that funding with fundraising activities. Now, realistically speaking, you have a job to do in an organization, then you have to fundraise. And you have to make sure that everything goes well and you're offering good services. It becomes too much. It becomes just too much. The demand is very great. And so I think that they haven't really thought this through.
And I suppose business also needs to
absolutely
respond to this. I mean, there's lots of lip service every time, you know, there's a protest or outcry or a high-profile murder of some poor young woman, then everyone's wringing their hands, but not really practically.
And people who
contribute
in the background have been doing the work and doing it for a long time and doing it for years, often are not given that kind of priority, you know. So it becomes very difficult, because everybody wants the sexy projects, you know. But the real work gets done when you look at the chakras on the day-to-day level. You know, the counseling, joy that we get is if you come here and you see a woman who's just walked in from an abusive relationship, right? She's disheveled, she might not be clean, she is completely disturbed. And then 3 to 6 months later, you see this woman, you can't recognize her.
Amazing.
And that is what gives us the joy and the pleasure to know that, you know what, you can make a difference in people's lives. And we're not making the difference. They're making the difference. We're just catalysts that really serve to help women to turn their lives
around.
Give
that space. That
you give them the environment. You don't blame them. You believe them. You offer them the support that you can. But sometimes we really hamstrung because a woman will need, for example, a lot of women come and they want to study, right? So they want to go to either university or they want to finish their high school. And there's no funding coming through for that. So shelters are really very much on their own, isolated in trying to make sure that these things happen. And it shouldn't be like that.
It's almost like just a sticking plaster as opposed to a stitch.
Absolutely.
Before we talk a little bit about the National Shelter Movement and that, because I'm actually quite interested in that whole environment, can I just ask you a little bit about your childhood and how you got into this work in the first place? You're in Lenasia, you grew up in Lenasia?
Well, partly in Johannesburg, in Ferreira's town. And then when I started high school, I used to commute by train to Lenasia to come to a high school here. Because remember, during the apartheid era, people from that side had to move over to Lenasia.
Okay, so you were, your family was forcibly removed to Lenasia. Can you remember that? Were you born?
Yes.
When
we moved to Lenasia, I think it was about the 1970s, and I was very upset and crying because we came to Lens and
it was a whole new development.
And the roads, there were no roads.
For the so-called Indian community.
Mud everywhere. And I was just very unhappy because where we were very happy.
What did your parents do?
No, so basically I didn't grow up with my parents. So my parents, my dad, wanted to study medicine. He applied at Wits and because of the quota system didn't get accepted into Wits. And of course the family was very poor, so they at that point couldn't help him, but with the help of other family members and extended family community, they managed to raise funds. He got a place in Dublin in Ireland. And so by that time he was married already, because it took a long time before that money could be raised. So they left and they went to Ireland, and he was studying in Dublin for many years. And my mom couldn't come back to South Africa for about 5 years because they didn't have the funds. And at that point, when she did come, she was pregnant with me. So she was highly pregnant. She came back to South Africa to meet her family and then gave birth here and couldn't take me back because it was become too difficult to maintain me. So I stayed with my grandparents.
My goodness.
And extended family and grew up here. So I was literally 3 weeks old when my parents, when my mom left me.
Sure.
And then, yeah, so I grew up.
And then
here.
Did you see them again, your parents?
Yes, only when I was, how old was I? About 7 or 8 years old. They came back to South Africa because my dad had finished his
medical
degree
studies,
and he wanted to do his internship. He started working at Baragwanath Hospital, but got treated really very badly. And in that time, he just felt, you know what, he couldn't deal with this.
Mm.
And
well, I mean, you can imagine he's been living in Ireland, a free man, for all those years, and comes back to this craziness of apartheid, right?
And then, so they stayed here for a while, and then he decided that he's not going to finish his internship here. So, of course, it wasted his time because he had to go and find an internship alternatively, and eventually he found an internship in Michigan in the U.S.
Yeah.
So, actually speaking, at that point in time, they took me with them. But they were traveling by ship, and I was really seasick. And we left from Durban, went to Cape Town, because by Union Castle.
Yeah, Union Castle Line from Durban. Yeah. I remember that, yeah.
And then
we used to go and see those ships.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was on there, but I was terribly sick. I couldn't eat. I couldn't hold anything down. And then the doctor on the ship said to them, you know what, it's a very long journey because it was Cape Town to Southampton.
Yes.
And then Southampton to...
what, New York?
Yeah. So...
so they dropped you in Cape Town?
So I said, I don't want to go with
them. Whoa.
But part of the problem was that I hadn't grown up with them. And I think at that point in time, it was difficult. I'm not sure how they understood or didn't understand it. I was their child, but I wasn't, hadn't lived or grown up with them. My dad's family were originally from India.
Okay.
But they were sent here when they were kids on their own.
Wow.
Yeah. So they grew up also kind of painfully.
Distant, yeah.
Yeah. And so when this happened...
so for your dad, it wasn't really an unnatural thing then for him to be so far apart from you, because he'd grown up so far apart from his parents.
Exactly. But he came with his brothers.
Hmm.
So there were about four or five brothers. And so eventually what happened from there on was she told him, and he couldn't accept it. Was very angry at me. And I didn't know what I was going to do. By that time, all my friends were going to... you had to go to Durban, Westville, University
right,
of Durban,
yeah,
Westville,
yeah,
that
yeah.
time.
Yes.
And my granny said to me, well, we don't have money to send you there either. So I said, okay, let's see what happens. And so my dad turned around and said, well, if I don't come, then I'm not funding you. So I said, okay, fine. I went to work. I joined Standard Bank and did a job I hated. And as I did the job, I said to myself, is this what you want to do your whole life long? Work in a bank like a robot and you don't use your brain. So all those things were kind of, you
percolating,
know,
bubbling.
Absolutely, and gave me a lot of time to reflect, and I knew I wasn't that kind of person. So by May of that year, I realized and I found out that UNISA existed, University of South Africa, and it was distance education. Mm. And so I enrolled with UNISA because I started earning money and I could pay my fees.
Yeah.
And I would come home, do my homework, do my assignments.
And this is for the psychology degree that you ended up
well,
doing? What did you start with?
Well, I did my BA, I did honors, okay. I did masters, I did a PhD. Mm. So I used to work all day, travel back to Lanesia, come back at night, sleep for a while, get up at 3 or 4 o'clock. Start doing assignments.
And then go to work?
And then go to work. And I did that till I finished my degree. And then I managed to get a job at the Department of Manpower. So that was a bit easier, but I did my honors while I was there as well. Then I saved some money and went for 1 year to WITS to do my master's.
What year is that?
1981, 82, okay. Something like that.
All right.
And then, you know, because you work with UNISA, you become diligent. So I had finished my thesis when my classmates were still kind of...
jawling around. Mm.
And because that happened, they started
failing. Distance learning, isn't it? It puts a lot of pressure on you to do
a lot of responsibility, a lot of discipline.
Yeah.
But we grew up fairly in a disciplined way. And, you know, the Islam as a religion also
gives you that guidance.
You. Yes, because, I mean, we taught to pray 5 times a day. There's a regularity about everything you do. And I think at that point in time, you don't see the value of it.
Mm.
It's kind of more after that that you'll start seeing, you know, how that has actually helped you with your discipline.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so I did that, and then 1 year went full-time and had a party because it was fun.
So much more, you could handle that.
It was easy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, the other one was like working the whole day, coming at night. Yeah.
Different tempo.
Not getting sleep. And plus, I was a young woman. Other people were going out and having fun, and I couldn't obviously do that. Because I needed to make sure that, and you know, it was the Martin Luther King stuff, like keep your eyes on the prize. You gotta get there. And this is nobody else. I'm driven. So that's what I did. And
did you become involved in student politics at all while you were at WITS or at any time during your, because that's quite a rambunctious time in our history, sort of 80s, late 70s.
We were involved in the protest movement and stuff like that. But at university, no, because it was only 1 year. Mm. And I had to get through all of...
Right, you put your focus on that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. And then...
I'm just trying to sort of relate to, you know, what your current activism, where it had its roots.
Yes. Well, I mean, we were always very aware. Attended like all the political rallies at school, were involved in the protests and all of that. But I was also very aware when I went to WITS that I need to finish.
Mm.
And I don't have the kind of backing.
Sure.
That
a lot of the other kids had.
And they were spoilt and everything. And, you know, I used to come home at 8 o'clock at night with a bus. My poor grandmother at that time used to wait for me. Because from now what's called Gandhi Square, you walk to WITS. That time there was no bus.
Jeepers. So your commute is like hours every day.
Well, that's what kills you, you know. Yeah. And then fortunately, when I did my master's, I had saved a bit of money. And one of my uncles said to me, he realized that this is too much. And they were worried about safety and stuff like that. So he said, I'll get you a second-hand car, and when you start working, you can pay me. So, because I was driving already, I had my license.
Right.
And so I kind of really learned to drive at WITS. Just couldn't park on those hills and
handbrake.
Yeah, oh my God.
Starts. Oof.
So that's what happened, and I mean, it got a bit better. And... Then that finished. Then I went to Sterkfontein. Oh, God. It's another nightmare of my life.
Sterkfontein?
Hospital.
Oh,
to do my internship.
Okay.
Fortunately, I wasn't there for 6 months. But I was horrified.
Hmm.
The way the patients were treated.
Is that a mental institution? Yes. We would call that...
Where black and white people were separated. And the black patients, men were taking advantage of women. The staff was stealing food from the patients. Oh,
God. Horrific!
It was terrible. And then after that experience, then I came into community psychology. They put me into the clinic where I used to go to Tara to get, and it was like
chalk and cheese.
Then I was in Soweto at the clinics for a while, seeing people kind of on an outpatient basis and all of that. And eventually finished. And then I started working. And the year later, my grandmother said to me, let's go to Canada. And I didn't really want to. And she said, let's go. And without my knowledge, she took all my certificates and photographs and everything. When we got to my parents, she showed them all of this, and he couldn't believe it.
Your dad?
Couldn't believe it. And, but I was, I don't...
You were so estranged by that stage from your parents.
Yeah, so I went and, I mean, I was okay. I was courteous, and but there wasn't the kind of connection that I had with the family here. And my uncles were wonderful human beings.
Yeah.
They really, you know, spent time, looked after me.
Yeah.
So that happened, and I spent time there, and I spent time in England with family. Then we came back, and I then carried
kicked
on.
Kicked it off, yeah. It's just a, what an amazing story.
Yeah, it is. It's quite a shocking story. But I was fortunate that I had... a lot of help along the way.
Sounds like you had a proper network here, proper like extended family.
Well, I had the family and the extended family. And then when I started studying psychology, I used to go for supervision to Dr. Marita Brink, you know, the sister of Andre Brink,
okay.
The writer.
Right.
And that was an amazing experience.
Mm.
So with her...
Well, she became a sort of mentor to you?
And still is. I mean, I still see her fairly... regularly, maybe not as frequently, but I still see her,
I want to just, before we're sort of running out of time all of a sudden, the National Shelter Movement, because that's, you know, it's you're talking about these TCCs and all these different NGOs offering not only counseling but training and education and all. So there seems to be a lot more going on in this sort of space than I think a lot of people are aware of, and a lot of it's sort of private initiatives, sort of funded externally, et cetera, but. Just tell us a little bit about the National Shelter Movement and why it is so important.
So the National Shelter Movement, we started it here in 2000, where we had the first conference of Southern African shelters. And at that time, what we realized is that shelters were working in isolation from each other. Mm. They had no support. So we wanted to then try and build this network. But after 2000, didn't have the funding. So then in 2007, I think we had some money. So we called another meeting of shelters across the country. And at this meeting, shelters decided that we need to have a body. And that's how the National Shelter Movement came into origin.
And that was to what get some kind of uniformity in terms of what the purpose of the shelter was, but also to... do an inventory of where the shelters are?
Where the shelters are, what are they doing, support them, capacity building, to be able to advocate and lobby on behalf of shelters, to do research. So we were born in 2008, and then we kind of got together. We tried to meet at least once or twice a year with all the shelters or the representatives in the provinces. And then we managed to develop a partnership with the Heinrich Böll Foundation. It's a German foundation that has an office locally.
What's the foundation again?
Heinrich Böll.
Oh, Foundation. Heinrich Böll, yeah.
Yeah. And so we started with them and we did research for a period of 3 years. That research is now published. It's all on shelters in 6 provinces of the country. And a lot of the findings are very similar to what the Commission for Gender Equality found. So we've used that to advocate on behalf of shelters. Mm.
Is there, again, also you find a lack of support and understanding from government in terms of the role of shelters? Or
I think now it's getting a bit better, but they don't always know. That's why you can see when we had these Commission for Gender Equality meeting in... December, it was quite shocking to see how government departments were really not able to respond to this issue. And the best thing that happened is that the commission was very hard on them. They had to come back with the right information, with the right people, with the right to be able to put things in place. So that gave me...
Some hope.
And I'm hoping now that with that. Because you see, the problem with government is they also need to work together, the different departments.
Yes, there's really too much silo thinking.
And they don't come to those meetings. And so I'm not sure how, but that has to change.
Mm. I was talking to a friend I had as a guest on the podcast, Frank Manches. He's a actor. Do you know Frank? Yeah. He was talking about the need for not only a functioning civil service, but actually a more activist-minded civil service. That seems to be lacking
absolutely
in this country.
Is. Absolutely.
That people are not doing the work there. That the kind of infrastructure is there, the resources are there, but there's no kind of vigor.
There isn't.
Hmm. One of the campaigns I saw that you'd been involved with at NISA is the We Are Those Girls.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we've done several of those kinds of things. Before we did We Are Those Girls, we did Women Rising Up and Moving On, which was a publication on women that had stayed in our shelter and were then invited to write their stories. And we facilitated that process. And after that, we were working at schools with girls and found out that they really had many, many difficult experiences. So we invited these girls and took them through this whole process. And that resulted in this book called We Are Those Girls. If you look at the pain that they had gone through, either through sexual abuse or incest or whatever the case may be, you know, in their communities. And then we carried on working with those girls to take them to a level where, you know, your past doesn't really infringe on what you want to do in your future, because you can let it go. Mm. And I mean, I'm an example of that.
I was going to say, yeah.
You can actually let it go, but it takes a lot of work and hard work and emotional and personal growth to be able to get to that point. Mm.
And that requires support for some people as well, then, doesn't it?
It does. And a lot of personality-wise, a lot of resilience. Mm. You know, if people are able to kind of connect the dots and
throw stuff away.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. So we did that project. It was extremely, well, very, very successful. Yeah.
Where do you see us right now as a country dealing with or not dealing with the scourge of gender violence? I mean, what do you think actually needs to happen here? I mean, is it beyond us to even think of an environment where we will? I don't say we'd ever get rid of violence because against women, because even in the most you would say prosperous societies on earth, there still is that issue of violence against women, of murder by an intimate partner. But you know, what does the future hold, do you think?
I think our commitment as a nation needs to be different to this issue. And I think that for a long time we haven't had the political will, because that's where it starts. And then you need to make sure that those resources are made available to people who want to do this work, right? And like you say, you may not get rid of it completely, but at least you can try and level the playing fields and give people an opportunity to live their lives. Because, you know, it is the worst thing to live in an intimate relationship with somebody who's overpowering you and, you know, really not giving you an opportunity to think, even.
So I mean, we're not even really talking about only physical violence.
It's never only physical violence. More than ever, you will always find emotional abuse, psychological, financial abuse as well. In some homes, if a woman earns money, she has to give it to her abuser. In other homes, if the man is earning, he's not sharing or doesn't tell her how he's budgeting. So those are the kinds of things. And then men need to be taught to do things differently. But I believe strongly that men need to come to the party to help other men. Because, you know, with our societies, they tend to listen to men more than they would to women giving in that kind of advice. Because often I've had a few clients who've come and said, yes, this, but you have to tell my wife she must do this, she must obey me, she must, you know, and that's not what we're about. That's not what we're about. There has to be some kind of egalitarian relationship. You need to consult each other. You need to share what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. So that becomes very difficult because a lot of men are very controlling, dominating. And also, a lot of them have grown up that way, so they can't see anything different. And so it's also important to go back to look at like socialization of younger girls and boys. Because you have homes where boys will be favored, girls have to do the chores, boys are not involved. And what does that actually tell them, and what are you teaching them? As opposed to if you have chores for both boys and girls, you know, and teaching them responsibility from an early age. Because a lot of the men are very insecure, have not really learned to take any responsibility.
Zubaydah, thanks so much for your time today. And I can only wish you power and strength in the work that you are doing.
Thank you. We need that desperately.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just what an impressive person, and you know, all those people working in that world, quite amazing. And you do get a sense of how little the response, the lack of understanding from the relevant government departments, even with this government commissions and, you know, all these ministries that are meant to be sort of supporting these poor women, mainly women and children, is quite disconcerting. But yes, as I say, the commitment, the dedication of all the social workers, the counselors, the people running shelters across the country under extreme personal stress and pressure, just I found it quite humbling, if I can use a corny term. And you know how she explained the joy that she and her colleagues get as they see the result, the fruits of their labor, as it were. Please, once again, Patreon.com/voicesfromSA. You can become a patron. You can decide how much these discussions are worth. But it would really help me keep the project alive and get to other parts of the country. That would allow me to tell more stories about some of the amazing people and incredible things going on. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You may also subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.